ACL injuries can be so troublesome for individuals. So on this episode of the Concast, we're going to talk about it. Massage therapist and sports injury therapist, and welcome to the Concast, a podcast where we discuss all things health, wellness, and injuries in an attempt to better understand the human body. We are rolling along in season number 2 with episode number 86, and this is an episode that I've wanted to do for a very long time because this injury is so prevalent in athletics, so prevalent in everyday society. That is an injury to the ACL. Whenever I have anybody in the clinic or whenever I'm speaking with somebody that injures their knee, everybody is concerned about their ACL. Many people are concerned about their ACL, but they don't know exactly what it is, and they've heard about how much of a problem it can cause when injured. And so this is an injury that the majority of people have heard about in some way, shape, or form. They've either seen it on TV or in athletics. And so I thought it would be a great episode to discuss where the research is at with this injury, some of the factors that might affect recovery, and then how you can go about helping yourself in the event that you've had this injury. I think first and foremost, we'll try and just understand what the ACL is. So an ACL is, or the ACL, is a ligament, and a ligament attaches bone to bone. So we've got ligaments in the body, we've got tendons in the body. Tendons attach muscle to a bone, and the ligaments attach bone to bone. So ligaments are a little bit less elastic than tendons, and one of the rules of ligaments, and there are hundreds if not thousands of ligaments within the body, is they help create a passive restraint in the body or passive stability. So when we talk about stability in the body, there are kind of examples of dynamic stability or reactive stability. If you think about, for example, you're running, your muscles and your tendons and your nervous system are stabilizing you as you run so you don't fall over. Or for example, if you're a running back in football and you're running through a scrum with the ball and you get hit on the side of your leg, your leg muscles help react against that hit and stabilize you and allow you to continue to run. So that is our dynamic system. Now we also have this static system in place to help attempt to save us when our dynamic system might fail us or become overworked. And that's where we talk about things like bone, cartilage, ligaments fall into that category, as well as joint capsules, which are kind of bags of tissue around the joints. And the ACL is a ligament. And so what it does is it resists what's known as anterior translation of the tibia being the lower leg bone and the femur being the upper leg bone. So it resists the lower leg bone moving forward on the upper leg bone, and it also resists internal rotation of that lower leg bone on the upper leg bone. So this particularly happens when we discuss ACL. It happens when the knee falls into a valgus force, typically with some degree of rotation. Now, a valgus force is if you're standing on your leg and you allow your knee to fall inward towards your midline. Now, if you're doing that on your own right now, it's not a huge deal. However, if you're doing that in the context of sport, or let's say your foot gets caught in a pothole and you fall and you're not able to really move your body away from the fall, your knee is taking the brunt of that load. We know that this can happen when a force is applied to it, but we also know with ACL injuries particularly, there's a lot of innocuous or benign injuries, which essentially means it's a surprise that the individual got injured because there wasn't really anybody around. We see this a lot with ACL injuries in soccer, particularly female soccer, where the athlete will be running, they will go to plant and twist, they will either slip or in the twisting motion, their foot gets fixed on the turf or the grass, more so on turf. And this is one of the reasons why AstroTurf was so problematic in professional women's soccer, because for the longest time, women's soccer at the professional level was not being solely played on grass. It was being played on turf. The foot was getting fixed. Athletes were rotating and tearing their ACL. These are known as non-contact ACL injuries. So that valgus force is the primary mechanism of injury. You can also get the injury in hyperextending the knee. So for example, if the knee is moving backwards, this can be done again in the context of a slip injury. It can also be done if somebody is tackling you in rugby, soccer, football, any contact sport. And so it really depends on the nature of the sport and what you're doing, but we do see ACL injuries with a specific mechanism, and then these sort of non-contact ACLs are very prevalent in female sports particularly, but any type of field sport, as I said earlier. Now, there are different grades of ACL injuries. The grade that we're going to be talking about today is a grade 3, which means you injure that ACL entirely. A grade 1 would mean that you would stretch it a little bit, but not deform it. A grade 2 would mean that you would actually tear some of the fibers, but the ACL, the ligament itself, would still be intact to some degree. And a grade 3 is the ACL tears in half. Now, depending upon the nature of your lifestyle, your activities, individuals can still get away with grade 1 tears or even grade 2 tears. And we'll talk about that a little bit later in the podcast. However, in the majority of professional sports, if you're getting a grade 2, 2 plus, or 3, you're getting that repaired and going through a surgical procedure to do that. So what we're going to do today is really discuss where the research is at with regards to returning to play after surgery. The reason this is that 35% of athletes, and the majority of this research is done in athletes, and I think that is one of the pitfalls of the research, but we'll touch on that later. 35% of athletes after an anterocruciate ligament reconstruction do not return to what was considered their pre-injury status of sport level performance within a 2-year period. And so this is a staggering stat when I read it in the research. And so what are things that are currently being discussed to try and reduce this number? Because essentially, over a third of athletes are not able to return to their pre-injury status performance level. This doesn't mean that they're not unable to return to sport, but when they do, and we'll talk about the different elements of sport, they're not performing at the level that they did prior to their injury. And this is within a 2-year period, which is quite a lengthy time frame to go through. The majority of the research that I read was around the discussion of hamstring and patellar tendon grafts being used for ACL repairs. So when the ligament is torn, typically what happens is a surgeon will go in and they will take a piece of your hamstring tendon or a piece of your patellar tendon, which is the tendon on the front of the kneecap, and they will form a new ACL for you and then implant that into the knee. There are also other methods of implantation using cadaver ACLs or quadricep tendon ACLs. And so I just want to preface this podcast by saying the majority of the research that I looked at looks at two things: return to sport, as well as the majority of the research papers that I looked at were looking at return to sport in environments where the hamstring tendon was used in surgery or the patellar tendon was used in surgery. And I think that's an important thing to just address before we get further into the topic. The first question that I often get around ACLs is, if I'm going in for surgery, does preoperative rehabilitation help me, or prehab? The thought behind prehab is, look, if I have this injury to a ligament and I know that I need to get my leg strong, do I put this off and wait until post-surgery and then start my rehabilitative process? Or is there an upside to starting the rehab before surgery, so my leg is as strong as it can be, I then go in and have surgery, and then I get my gains, quote unquote, back a little bit more quickly because I've gone through this prehab process? So does prehab help? And or are there concerns before surgery that seem to lead to longer prognosis or recovery times or issues following surgery? So the first thing that I saw in the research was a preoperative extension deficit, and what that means is the knee won't fully extend, is a major risk factor in an extension deficit after the repair. So what that means is if your knee is stiff and you're having trouble extending it and you can't get full knee extension, then that is a major risk for post-operative issues in gaining back your extension. So what this means is that if you're going in for an ACL tear repair, you want to know first, do you have full knee extension? And if not, is this something that you can work on with your therapist? Or if you're a therapist listening, is this something I can work on as the therapist to try and gain full knee extension prior to going in for surgery? The other notable piece of information that I found was a preoperative deficit in quadriceps strength of greater than 20% has a significant negative consequence for self-reported outcomes 2 years after repair. So there are a couple of recommendations regarding this, is trying to get quadriceps strength before surgery, so doing prehab to gain quadriceps strength, as well as hamstring strength. So strengthening the front and back of the leg before surgery. The third piece of information is really about the prehab process at large. In terms of prehab, in terms of self-reported knee function measures up to 2 years after repair, they seem to be a little bit more positive. So in terms of the athlete or the patient or the individual that's gone through the repair, they have better self-reported measures within that 2 year time frame. And we know, as I talked about at the top of the podcast, that 2 year time frame seems to be key for gaining back function. So it appears that prehab or pre-rehabilitation, particularly if there's an extension deficit or if there's a lack of quadricep strength, which there almost always is in these acute injuries, that there is value in strengthening the leg before surgery. So you get that leg nice and strong, and then you go in for your repair. And the question now is, well, what do I do post-operatively as my rehabilitation? The first question is, would I be able to do an at-home program, or is there benefit in going to see a therapist? Now, in the research, it's really unclear whether a supervised rehab program versus a non-supervised rehab program is more beneficial. And this is an assumption that's being made at large. However, it does appear that a minimally supervised program may result in better outcomes in specific groups, particularly if individuals are highly motivated and want the assistance of a therapist. Secondly, if they live away from a physiotherapist and they can't really get to them on a regular basis. And thirdly, it allows the therapist to monitor the patient or the person in doing things that they may not be ready to do. And so one of the primary things that you don't want to do post-surgery is you don't want to go too quickly because you have a likelihood of potentially re-injuring that ligament and then going in for a ligament repair a second time. Now, what about things like outcomes with the length of a particular rehab program? Well, there have been some studies looking at program lengths, for example, a 19-week long program versus a 32-week long program. This particular study hasn't found any difference in laxity, range of motion, self-reported knee function, hop test, strength, etc. However, again, this doesn't necessarily mean that in particular subsets of the population, the length of the program does not matter. I think it's important, again, in terms of rehab length, to look at the particular individual in person and then adjust the rehab program according to them. Because if your patient is an elite level athlete and you're taking them through a 19-week program that doesn't involve sport-specific activities, them regaining their function in a variety of environments, the chances of re-injury are quite high. And so that is something that definitely needs to be taken into consideration. One of the other concerns is, when can I start to weight bear? When can I put my foot back down on the ground with or without crutches? It seems to be in the research that immediate weight bearing doesn't seem to cause any increased incidence of knee laxity or joint laxity or re-injury. And in fact, the earlier you start to weight bear, it seems to decrease anterior knee pain over time, or self-reported anterior knee pain. So getting the knee joint moving and getting immediate weight bearing as tolerated, either with a crutch, a couple of crutches, one crutch, and getting them to the point where they're able to walk properly, have no joint swelling, is really, really important. So you can't just say to somebody, okay, you got to put your foot down, you got to go. One of the things that's important is we don't want individuals limping. So can you walk with two crutches and be partial weight bearing and work on your gait? Is that causing you excessive swelling or pain? So there is an art to getting people to weight bear appropriately again. However, at large, the process of weight bearing does not seem to be detrimental. In fact, it seems to be positive. So getting weight bearing in some way, shape, or form in a supervised fashion will help you along the way. Now, speaking about joint effusion, many people are using things like ice or ice cuffs to help with pain, as well as they're told that that helps with the swelling. It appears that in the research, cryotherapy is effective at decreasing pain immediately after post-surgery, roughly within a week. However, it doesn't really have any immediate effects on post-operative swelling per se. So individuals can use things like cold packs, the circulating cold cuffs to help try and manage pain. However, at large, again, it may not necessarily manage the swelling. Now, that doesn't mean that ice or ice cuffs aren't useful. It just means that the predominant mechanism by which they're acting is trying to make the patient more comfortable, or the athlete more comfortable, which allows them to go about all these other things maybe a little bit more efficiently. So what I took away from that piece of research that I read was having some degree of supervision may in fact be important. The length of the program matters and is dictated really by the patient that's going through it, or the person rather that's going through it, their particular need out of their knee. Weight bearing early is important, and cold type therapies can be used to reduce pain. So the other piece of research that I was reading is from a consensus statement. And a consensus statement is really a group of experts in a field get together and they try and come to a consensus on a number of topics surrounding the particular injury or the particular disease that they're discussing. And so I think it's important to, particularly in the sporting realm, come to these consensus statements, because as therapists, it helps guide us in not only communicating with the patient, but just understanding what is important in the grand scheme of things when we talk about injuries. And so what I want to do next is just summarize some of the findings in some of the consensus statements that I've read regarding ACL injuries. The first is, do we think it's important that a sports medicine individual, sports medicine doctor, helps return an athlete to play and clears an athlete to progress through the rehab program? And it's pretty clear that this is a vital part of rehab. So the primary reason is, and this can be multifactorial, it doesn't necessarily have to be a sport medicine doctor, however they are usually involved, but it might be the physical therapist, it might be a sports psychologist as well. They need to be involved in the returning the athlete to play process. This is a vital part to prevent re-injury. It's a vital part to kind of pull the reins in on some athletes that are a little bit too eager to get back to sport too early. And so this is a really, really key part. Secondly, a clearance to return to full participation should be followed carefully by a structured plan that is progressive and gradually gets an athlete back to competition. This is typically going to happen over a minimum period of time of around 9 months for most athletes. Now, in terms of some of the rehab strategies and guidelines for returning athletes to play following an ACL, isometric strength is definitely used very early in the process within the first 2 weeks, and even the first week, if the individual is able to tolerate it, they're starting to use isometrics to try and regain some of that function back in the leg muscles, particularly in the quadriceps or the front of the leg muscles. This is sometimes combined with electrical stimulation, putting pads on the quadriceps and using electrical stimulation to help facilitate this process. There is some evidence within about the first 2 months following a repair that electrical stimulation along with exercise may perform a little bit better. However, in the long-term grand scheme of things beyond that two-month period, there isn't necessarily the distinct conclusions. So using electrical stimulation in your rehab within that first 0 to 2 month period may be beneficial. From that period of time, as strength gains throughout the leg again, around week 4, individuals can start doing open chain kinetic exercises. Typically, these open chain exercises are usually restricted to around a range of motion of 90 to 45 degrees. So if the individual's gait is starting to come along, if they're starting to weight bear appropriately, if they've done some of these preemptive exercises, the isometric exercises, maybe using electrical stimulation or not, they can start these open chain exercises. One of the things that is a point of caution, however, is adding weight to these exercises a little bit too early in the process within the first 12 weeks. This is really to prevent the ACL graft from elongating. And so range of motion can be gradually increased over kind of a 4 to 8 week period, and then gradually increasing range of motion from there, adding some weight in open chain exercises around week 12, and then progressing appropriately. The other particular point of discussion in the research that I was reading was the addition of neuromuscular training. Neuromuscular training really focuses on the quality of movement as well as reactivity, and the discussion around altered movement potentially being a risk for second ACL injury or subsequent ACL injury. And so the recommendations as such were to integrate neuromuscular training as part of the rehab. So it's important that the rehab process, again, is kind of multifactorial. You don't want to be just focusing on range of motion and strength. The addition of some of these reactive-based drills is really, really important at some period of time along the way. And at large, there are really three phases of return to full performance. There's a return to participation, which is usually preceded by a sports medicine professional clearing the individual for unrestricted training. This means that the athlete is physically active, they can train, but is medically, physically, and psychologically not ready to return to their sport. There's a return to full participation period of rehab, which is preceded by a return to sport testing and a multifactorial decision approach involving the entire team involved, therapist, sports psychologist, medical doctor, surgeon. There's then the return to sport, which is not a return to performance. This return to sport phase has structured reevaluations throughout it. And the decision to return to sport is again multifactorial. And during this return to sport phase, the athlete has returned to the quote unquote defined sport, but their desired performance level hasn't yet been reached. So they're not operating on a full octane approach. They might be doing some sport specific drills. They're continuing to do their rehab. However, they're not ready to perform. And the final phase is return to performance. So during the return to performance phase, the athlete has returned to their defined sport and they are performing at pre-injury level. And so this is kind of when we talk about the entire rehabilitative process, how it's viewed. Return to participation, return to sport, return to performance. Now, I talked about this multifactorial approach. One of the things in the research that is somewhat clear in the multifactorial approach, the exclusion of a coach's decision as to when an athlete will return to play or return to performance or return to sport. Medical professionals have cited this as a huge conflict of interest. And so a lot of the time when you hear coaches, and the irony of this is coaches get asked a lot about athletes' return to play decisions. So they'll say, do you have information on athlete A? And many coaches just say, I don't really, I default to the medical staff. And I think it's because a lot of organizations don't allow coaches to have a say necessarily on the health of their athletes because they've recognized that there can be bias in that decision. You can have pressure from a coaching staff. This happens a lot at the professional level. However, at the amateur level, it may be worse because coaches may have, if you don't have a distinct medical staff where people are making decisions, and coaches do have input, they may be returning athletes to play too early, and that may be jeopardizing the long-term health of that athlete. Now, speaking of the long-term health of the athlete, how long does it typically take for an ACL to get better in a sporting environment, and how long does it take an athlete to get back to their high performance level? And you heard me say 9 months. However, as the research advances, purely time-based return to sport decision-makings have been abandoned, so to speak, in terms of more clinical-based decisions. So things like achieving normal joint balance, which is the absence of swelling and the absence of pain. Does the athlete have neuromuscular control and proprioception? Do they have strength in the quadriceps, the leg, the hip? And this might take 2 years in certain individuals before they can return to a high performance level. However, in saying that, there is an important role for time-based considerations in respecting the healing process of the graft. So we can do all of the rehab that we want, but sometimes we don't and can't speed up how the body heals itself. And there was a study done in 2016 by Grindham in the British Journal of Sports Medicine that emphasized that. And what they found was in that for every month unrestricted competition or return to unrestricted competition rather was delayed up until the 9 month period post-operatively, the re-injury incidence of ACL graft was reduced by 51%. So there seems to be something in the research about the 9 month period, and most research will say that the minimum time an individual, absolute minimum time an individual needs to be out is 6 months. But in really high performance settings, 9 to 12 months is what you typically see. So the return to sport decision, it must include some sort of physical examination, including clinical testing. It must include things like range of motion. Is the joint swollen? Is the joint laxed, which is typically measured by a therapist or a surgeon using a few tests called a Lockman's test or a pivot shift test? And does the athlete or individual have good quadricep and hamstring strength? So along with the physical exam, what about things like standardized tests for helping determine the performance side of things? Because we can look at the joint, we can measure the joint range of motion, we can measure the joint laxity, and we can understand, yeah, the joint feels stable or it doesn't feel stable. But what about things like running and jumping and hopping in sport and changing direction? This is something that's been more discussed in around the last 10 years in the research. And the thing that we can't get clear on is what specific tests are better than others. So there's a variety of different hop tests, for example. There's a variety of different tests that look at quality and quantity of movement. So it's not clear in the research whether one test at large performs better than the other. But what is clear is there should be some type of hop test involved. There should be some assessment of quality of range of motion. There's also some discrepancies in something known as a limb symmetry index, which is the strength and size of the operative limb versus the non-operative limb before the return to sport. A limb symmetry index of around 90% is the typical minimum cutoff point, but 100% is better. What that means is that the balance between both legs is either equal, better than the non-operative leg, or within 90% of the non-operative leg. So really, some degree of testing involving strength testing, quality of movement, and some type of hop testing to gauge whether the athlete is ready to return to sport. This is also going to involve just drills that are very commonly involved in their sport. Again, the return to sport testing for a football player is not going to be the same return to sport testing as a tennis player. And for that reason, really tailoring the return to sport battery of tests against that specific athlete's needs and demands is what's really, really important. And having that in place, not necessarily the particular testing that you're doing at that time. Now, one of the things that I haven't really touched on yet is the psychology of the athlete and talking about psychosocial factors involved in return to play. There are ACL psychological validated questionnaires that individuals can use to help see where the athlete is from a psychological perspective. The ACL-RSI, or Return After Injury questionnaire, is a proposed psychological tool that's used a lot, and it's just trying to identify the readiness for the athlete to return to the sport. The other thing that can be problematic is early confidence of the athlete. If the athlete is too confident, it can have negative consequences. Particularly, we know that athletes at a younger age are at higher risk of re-injury because of this confidence, and if they're not being guided by a healthcare team, sometimes they can be a little bit too eager to get back, which can increase their incidence of re-injury. So along with the biological aspect of the injury, there should be some sort of measure of where the athlete is at from a psychological perspective. The higher level the athlete, typically the more they identify with being an athlete. So they're going to go through all of those psychological emotions from depression, anxiety, anger as they go through the post-surgical phases of healing and rehabilitation, particularly if this is a more drawn-out prognosis. So it's really, really difficult if the athlete is a high-performance athlete to come to the fact that they might not be playing their sport for 9 to 12 months or potentially longer if there are complications. And for this reason, having a sports psychologist as part of the team or a counselor, as well as a good support system around the athlete as they go through this process, is really, really important. So really what it comes down to is there's a host of contextual factors that are involved in returning someone to high performance. And even if you're not a high performance athlete, if you've had an ACL injury, you're going to go through very similar processes of the psychosocial factors, managing range of motion, managing strength, doing exercises before surgery, and then starting exercise after surgery. And you're going to, again, build on those phases of strength, reactivity, and such. And so if you are not a professional athlete, it is very similar in terms of the process and can be approached in a similar way. Now, the last thing that was really discussed in some of these consensus statements is, what if an individual has a comorbid injury along with the ACL. So it's very common to injure the cartilage of the knee or the meniscus at the same time, particularly if the injury was at a high rate of speed. Depending upon the research you read, meniscus injuries are often reported with ACL injuries anywhere from 20 to 40% of the time. 20 to 30% of the time, the cartilage is also damaged. There is some thought that this might affect and prolong healing times. However, there's really a lack of literature on exact considerations in these circumstances, as well as exact parameters. So really in the research right now, we don't have great guidance on, you know, sometimes what's known as an unhappy triad injury, where you've damaged ACL, meniscus, and the MCL ligament as well, or you've damaged the ACL, the meniscus, and the cartilage. These kind of comorbid injuries are a little bit more complex, but we don't really necessarily have the guidance there in the research to help us along the way. So they're managed on an individual basis. We're probably going back to a lot of the things that we've discussed throughout the podcast, things like range of motion, neuromuscular strength, psychological factors as well. However, the expectation might be for the individual that as had more than one tissue injured, that it may be a little bit of a drawn out recovery process because of that. So throughout today's episode, we've talked a lot about the return to sport and athletes, because this is where the majority of the research on ACLs lies. And I think this is one of the things that might be a bit of a pitfall of the research, because there are plenty of active individuals that aren't professional athletes that injure their ACL for a variety of factors. Some people opt to not go through a surgery because they aren't a professional athlete. Maybe they're an individual in their mid-50s or mid-60s, and there isn't a lot of swelling in the knee, and they feel as though they can do some exercises and get back to full function. Regarding decision-making around a lot of these cases, in my experience, and I have had individuals that are not getting their ACL repaired, and I would say it's becoming a little bit more popular, a lot of this decision-making is really centered solely around the physical exam. So does the surgeon feel like the knee is stable without the ACL? I'm really unaware of any research looking at non-sport populations at large. And I think this might be a problem, because when you're looking at solely the structural aspect and not the functional aspect, look, if I test somebody's ACL on the table and they don't have one and it feels structurally sound, that doesn't necessarily mean that that structure is going to translate into them skiing down a hill and hitting a jump and then landing. And so I think that if you are an individual that's considering whether or not you want to have your ACL repaired and a surgeon has told you that it is functional, maybe going to a therapist and allowing them to take you through some of these battery of tests that are often used in the sporting environment, and maybe helping you make your decision and saying, look, in that hop test, I actually had some knee pain, and can we flush this out with rehab over a 3 to 4 month period? Or does this knee continue to bother me in this position? This is a position that I want to do in a more demanding environment like skiing, or I'm not a skier and I want to just be able to garden and that's what I want to do. And really coming to a conclusion based on a variety of factors, most notably on your lifestyle and what that might mean, whether you have an ACL or don't moving forward, as well as things like your overall health profile, the risk of going through surgery, complications, etc. So there are plenty of other contextual factors for rates of re-injury. Is there a potential health factor that's associated with rates of re-injury, something like a connective tissue disorder? Were you compliant in your rehab? What's your age at time of surgery? All of these things are really things to consider when considering whether or not you should have your ACL repaired. I've had athletes that the surgeons have told them that they should be fine in playing their sport without an ACL, and they've chosen to get it repaired for the psychology of it. They just play high level athletics and they won't feel comfortable in their sport knowing that they don't have an ACL, particularly if it's a contact sport. And you can't necessarily fault that individual for going through that process to make sure that from a psychological perspective, they're able to return to full performance. Now, even if you were to choose to not get your ACL repaired, you would do yourself a great benefit in going through a rehab process, a lengthy one, 3, 4, 5, 6 months, to get the leg as strong as possible. And seeking out the help of a therapist that's well-versed in dealing with these type of injuries to get you back to your activities of daily living, either as much as possible or to your pre-injury status. So I do really hope a review of this information has helped. My question for you is, and there are so many of you out there, have you torn your ACL? How long did it take you to get back to your pre-injury status? If you're an athlete, your high performance status, I'd love to know in the comments below. What are some things that you did that helped? What are some things that hindered your rehabilitation process? Feel free to comment below. As always, I hope that you found this episode to be of value to you. Have yourselves a great weekend, and we will see you in the next one.